My name is Clancy Immer, an alcoholic. But I want to do something because I'm a speaker and I've come a long way and I can get away with almost anything. I would like to ask anyone with 54 years or more of sobriety to please stand up. Now that's the banner. Now sit down. As important as the new man is, that man's been holding the door open for you for a long time. Glad to have you here, Warren. I'm glad to be here tonight, as I like to say, safe and sane and sober. Last night I went to an affair in Minneapolis, a retreat, and a 25th anniversary of the retreat. I'm happy to see the chairman of the president is here tonight. And a number of the members. Very nice affair. And I'm glad to be here for this intergroup meeting tonight. I had kind of a tough trip up here. I live in Los Angeles where you get up where it's warm and get on an airplane and get off, you're cold and sneeze and terrible. But it isn't really the worst trip I ever had. The worst trip I ever had is about 4 years ago. I had to go speak in Reykjavik, Iceland, which is beyond any lengths, I'll tell you. And you come back, and you're on Air Iceland. I don't know if you've ever seen an Air Iceland plane. They come to Minneapolis. They got hair under the wings. And it's just terrible. And I had about a four-hour wait in the chamber, in Old Chamberlain Airport, and I sat there, and it was Sunday night, not many people around, and I was tired. And I went to the red carpet room, which is the United room for frequent flyers, and I sat there and there's hardly anybody around, drank a cup of coffee, and I had to go to the bathroom. So I went in the bathroom, nice little bathroom, two little stalls side by side, all very neat. And I sat in one of them, was thinking about things, and I heard a voice say from the next stall, "Hi there." I don't know what they're, he said, "What are you doing tonight?" I better quash this right away. Because I'm going back to Los Angeles to see my wife and children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but thank you very much for asking. There was a long pause, and the voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight." And I was tired. I didn't act like a good AA. I don't want to hear any more of your stuff. I'm not here for that. I got a different reason for being here. Why don't you just shut up? There was a long pause. The voice said, "I'll have to call you back. The jerk in the next stall won't shut up." I call that a bad trip. But you know, I was enjoyed listening to the various contributions tonight regarding your central office, your intergroup office, the traditions and the various things. And I want to talk a little bit about tonight, because this is the 75th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of you were at the International Convention in San Antonio. I was. And this is the signal for crying. Oh! And I travel around a lot, because I've been sober a long time, not as quite as long as you are, Warren, but you old-timers are ruining AA. We newcomers with only 52 years won't put up with this. But I travel around a lot a bit, and I talk a lot of places, and there's certain things that happen in AA, and since this is a decimal year, and we're all interested because you're members of the intergroup, it's something to think about. There's some movements in AA in various places. You may or may not have heard of some of them. But there seem to be good movements. There's a movement to relax the restrictions in our traditions. So you don't really have to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's so many young people now who are just drug addicts and need help, and we're keeping them out by saying you have to be an alcoholic. Is it time to modernize AA and reduce this restriction to people in need, perhaps? Then there's also a movement to change the book. They say it's a nice book, but it's written in archaic 1930 language. It really doesn't get the cutting edge of young people. And the third big one that's taking place in several places, to stop saying the Lord's Prayer, to use the to intervene with the Serenity Prayer, because the Lord's Prayer is such a Christian thing that it offends our non-Christian members. And these all have great enthusiasts, and they preach them, and I've listened to a lot of arguments from them. I want to just for a few minutes tonight for my talk on this anniversary evening to talk about these things. And it does seem reasonable, doesn't it? We know being alcoholics is that's kind of almost outdated, alcoholics or alcoholics. And it's kind of a strange thing. Why are we so concerned about alcoholics? And to understand that, you have to understand the history of alcoholism a little bit. You know, there's been written records of alcoholics of our type for 4,000 years, back in prehistoric times. At one time, they thought they must be possessed by the devil. They'd kill them, execute them, they'd whip them and beat them up and put them in jail and send them away. And this went on for years. And when I was born down in Eau Claire. Did you see a signal? But this is a better one. This is for spontaneous applause. Yeah. When I was born in Eau Claire, there still was no answer for people like us. I mean, I didn't know it or didn't care because I was a little boy. But I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old, you know. And when I was a little boy, there was no answer. There were still people like us. The best thing I had was the Keeley cure. You remember the Keeley cure, Warren? Where they'd give you alcohol and put drugs in it, which made you sick. And you drink it. Oh, do you want any more? No, I don't. Cured. And a lot of them didn't get by the first bar where they didn't put drugs in the alcohol, you know. You put drugs in here? No, good. And we know the story of Bill Wilson and a funny series of incidents is a guy in New York went to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung treated him for his nerves, and he got drunk again, and he said, I can't treat you again because I see now that you're a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no treatment for your condition in the world today at any cost. That was 1931. And he came back and got to the Oxford group, kind of a religious group, and he went to up in Vermont on a vacation and saw his childhood friend, Ebby, and who was about to go to the penitentiary, and he talked to the judge and says, I used to drink too, and you know my father, so release him to me and I'll take him to New York. And he did, and he took him to New York. And in New York, Ebby, as part of the Oxford group meeting, had to testify about what he'd found. And he didn't want to testify. But he thought, I'll testify to somebody who won't remember it, maybe. So we found his old friend Bill Wilson, this drunken ne'er-do-well bum living in Brooklyn. And he thought, I'll testify to Bill. He won't remember it the next day. That'll be good. And so he, as we read in our book, Bill Wilson said, Ebby came to the door, clean, sparkling. He said, Ebby, you're sober. You're doing well. What's going on? He says, I found religion. Which ended the conversation as far as Bill was concerned. Oh, really? I'm really glad to hear that, yeah. But I heard Ebby speak in 1960 at the International Convention, and he talked about a little bit more involved, how he came in and sat at the table with Bill, and he tried to tell him about the Oxford group, and Bill just drank as fast as he could. That's really good, Ebby. I'm glad you're doing good. And so Ebby left, feeling chagrined, and he came back 3 days later and he had the Oxford group closer with him. Want to talk to you, Mr. Wilson, about the Oxford group? And Bill Wilson responded the way I hope any of us would, got drunker than ever. Screw you, screw the Oxford group. And a few months later, November, he got thinking, I really treated Ebby badly. He was trying to help me. I'm going to go over and apologize. He's living in this mission on Broadway in New York. And he went over there, got drunk on the way just to build up his confidence. Got to the mission. Ebby wasn't there, but he gave a short sermon to all of them just so they'd learn something. Staggered on down the street. Soon thereafter, was back in the hospital again. And the doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I have some bad news for you. Your husband is back in the hospital. I'm afraid this may be his last trip back. because I don't believe he'll survive another time like this. I would certainly suggest you do something to try to help him stop drinking. And she panicked and called Abby at the mission. Would you go up and talk to Bill? And he went up to a couple of guys. He said, Bill, you've got to find a power greater than yourself, Bill. Bill said, I don't want to hear that religious crap. Leave me alone. I said, okay. And away they went. That's the end of that. And in the middle of the night, this drunken ne'er-do-well bum, as he wrote later, cried out in desperation, if there's a God, show yourself! And all of a sudden, the room filled with light. And he felt like there's a wind coming through the closed windows. He said, my God, I'm going insane. I'm going insane. And he just shivered. Then the lights went down again, and the wind stopped. In the morning, he told his doctor about it. He said, doctor, did I snap? Did I wig out? Did I go crazy? He said, no, Bill. I don't know what it was. But looking into your eyes, you've changed somehow. Whatever you found, hang on to it. Although neither one of them knew it, he was one of the very, very, very few people that ever had a spontaneous spiritual experience. And he came out of there and he went to the Oxford group. And he got caught up in the Oxford group. He really liked it. Boy, this is great. Because he associated, because Abby was in the Oxford group, so he thought he should be in the Oxford group. And he thought, Abby helped me stop drinking. I'm going to help people stop drinking. And every day for 6 months, he'd pick up street drunks and bring them to the Oxford group. I don't know if you know what the Oxford group was. It was like a upper-class people sitting in one another's homes discussing spiritual values. And he's drunk and puked. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. And sometimes he took him home when they had no place to go. He was just really gung-ho. And he got up after 6 months of this one morning, and he noticed that the guy he brought home the night before had left early in the morning and apparently stolen the coffee pot to sell for wine. And he watched his wife, who had been a petite society girl when he married, now old before her time, salt and pepper hair, old clothes, putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve to go to work in some cheap little department store so she could afford to pay the rent so he could go to the Oxford group and help people. And he had a terrible wave of remorse. He said, Lois, the guy I brought home last night left, apparently to get drunk. And you know something, honey? I've done you a terrible disservice. For 6 months, I've been trying to help people, and not one person has stayed sober. And I'm going to get a job tomorrow, even if it's just shoveling dirt. You can stay home. I'm so sorry I made you go through all this. I regret it so much. I thought I had some great calling to help drunks, and I've got no calling to do anything. And he says, just think, Lois, not one person stayed sober. And I'll tell you something. At that moment, your life and mine hung by a thread about that big. And she turned and said something to him that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her about 30 years ago in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how'd you ever think of that answer? What a remarkable answer. She said, I don't know, it just seemed obvious. He said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did? He said, oh, yeah. That's why old-timers don't have much. That's why old-timers don't have much hair in front. They just go through life, oh, yeah. So he went down to the hospital to talk to his friend, the doctor. He said, Doc, I've been sober 6 months. I thought I had some ability to help people. I've been in the Oxford group trying to bring them to the Oxford group meetings. They all get drunk. He said, the doctor said, well, you're doing it wrong, Bill. You're trying to teach them religion. No drunk ever got sober on religion. He said, what you got to tell them is how you feel and how you felt and what drinking did for you and why you drink. That may be the only thing you can tell them. He said, but that doesn't seem right. He said, try it. Well, I'll try, but I don't know how to do that. And he got home, and he got a phone call. He offered a job. Bill, you used to be big on Wall Street, and now you're a bum, but we're going to give you a chance. I understand you've been sober 6 months. We're putting a deal together out in Akron. We're going to buy some proxies up at this company, machine tool company. We're going to send you out to get those proxies, and you'll be president of the company, and you'll be back in business. Don't screw up, because if you do, you'll never work here again. but give it a try. Oh, yeah, excited. You know, to Akron, Ohio. 2 days, the whole deal blew up. And he found himself standing in the hotel lobby on a Saturday in May. He reached his pocket. He had a $10 bill. He could either pay the hotel bill or take a train home. He didn't really want to go home because he'd have to go home and admit failure again and be nothing ever again. And he didn't want to stay very well. And as he wrote later, over here in this hotel lobby was a little room. I stood in that lobby some years ago trying to recreate the feeling. I'm kind of a romanticist. He described there's a little door over there, and over there was a curved sign, neon, said cocktails. And he heard the jukebox music coming out. And as he wrote, I knew if I just had a couple drinks, I could think of an answer. Boy, we all know that feeling, don't we? He says, and away he went. And God, it just makes me shiver to think how close we came to dying that day. Now, to the corner of his eye, I saw some telephones over there. And in small town hotels, I don't know if you remember it, but they have some phones and they have the ministers' names over it. And he remembered he'd promised his friends in the Oxford group he'd call somebody in the Oxford group before he got drunk. So he went over there and took the first name and called it. Man said, he said, I'm a rum hound from New York and I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford group. The man said, I don't know what you're talking about, sir. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me. And hung up. And the next guy didn't answer. And the next guy didn't answer. And the next guy said, I can't help you. I don't know what you're referring to. And he started to go. God, it's just out of the corner of his eye, I saw the last name down there, Walter Tunk. He said, I don't want to fail to call Walter Tunk so he can hurt me too. So he called Walter and said, I'm a rundown from New York and I'm the Oxford group. I'm trying to find you with the Oxford group. Can you help me? And by a stroke of great luck or divine intervention, he was the only man in Akron who could have helped him. He said, funny you should call. I have a very wealthy woman in my parish, and she was telling me just yesterday that her doctor admitted he was a drunkard in their Oxford group meeting this week. Maybe you could get together with the doctor. He said, yes, yes. He said, wait in the phone booth. So the minister called the heiress out in West Akron. She said, yes, yes, I'd like to have him talk to Dr. Smith, because he's a nice man, but drunkard. So the heiress called Mrs. Smith, and the phone rang once, and twice, and three, and four, and five, about to hang up. Hello, this is Mrs. Smith. She'd been outside in the yard, came running in, and the heiress explained to her, said, could you possibly, you think we could get together with the doctor? She said, well, the doctor's laying drunk on the floor, so drunk he can't get up. It couldn't be today, but maybe we could do it tomorrow. She said, okay, come out to my mansion in West Akron. And so she called the minister back. He said, great. He called Bill Wilson back, who was just about to leave that phone booth. He'd been waiting a long time, and they said, brother, just nothing. And told him how to get it to that mansion on the streetcar. And the next day, Bill Wilson went out there in the streetcar, and the doctor and his wife sitting in the back of their own car, him so sick and drunk, I mean, hungover, and his son and daughter in the front seat. Some of you may have met his son. He was in Al-Anon for many years, young Bob Smith. He's dead now, but he's an old man now. But he was 16 then, 1935. And he always used to talk about driving out there, his dad telling his mother, Ann, I'll go out and talk to this guy. I'm not going to listen to any damn lecture about my drinking. I'm so sick of hearing lectures about my drinking. I'm not going to do that anymore. I know I've ruined Mother's Day for you today, but I'll give him 10 minutes, Ann, but that's all I'm going to give him. Okay, so they got out of the mansion. These guys got together and went into the room for their 10 minutes and came out 4 hours later. The doctor said, my God, Ann, that's the first man I ever heard who seems to understand how I feel and why I drink and what a couple of drinks does for me. He says, I can't believe it. He said, Bill, you're a miracle. Could you stay with us for a couple of weeks? And Bill thought, let's see. I have no way to get out of town. Yes, I can. So he moved in with them. And every day he and Dr. Bob got together and talked about the Oxford group. and the spiritual values, and how you could enhance your beliefs, and how you could live a more loving Christian life. At the end of 2 weeks, the doctor was just doing so great. He said to Bill, he said, this weekend there's the National Convention of American Medical Association in Atlantic City. I was there last year, and I was so drunk they all ridiculed me. And I'm going to go there this year, and I'm going to be in shape. I'm going to show them what I've found. You stay here with my wife and kids, Bill, and I'll be back Tuesday morning. Away went. Tuesday morning, phone rang 6 o'clock. Mrs. Smith answered. Woman said, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. This is doctor's nurse. They carried him off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And a station agent knew I worked for him, so he called me, and I got down there, and a cab driver and I have him on the floor of his office here. I'm so sorry. I know he was trying so hard. And there, again. So Mrs. Smith and Bill Wilson, his new friend, went out and got him, brought him home, put him to bed. He was the worst type of drunk, a crying drunk. God, they're a nasty bunch. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Boom! And a couple days later, he sat upright and said, my God, what day is it? He said, Thursday morning, Bob. He said, Thursday morning? Oh, my God. I've got to do a cancer surgery today. Look at my hand. I can't do a cancer surgery. My God, they'll take my license. What did I do? Oh, my God. So they got him up, bathed him, and clothed him. And his new friend, Bill, got him a couple drinks to steady his hand. Sent him up to the hospital. Said, I'll be home by 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock, they waited for him. Didn't come home. 2 o'clock, 3, 4, 5. Everybody knew the old son of a bitch was drunk again. But suddenly the door burst open. And here's Bob, sober. Said, oh, do I feel great. I'm glad to be home. He said, where have you been, Bob? He said, while I was doing that surgery, it suddenly struck me. In the Oxford group, they tell us to make amends to people that we've hurt. And I thought that doesn't apply to a doctor. But I realize I'm a human being first. So I've been all day, all over Akron, making amends to people. And I feel wonderful. That was June 10th, 1935, which was the founding of our organization. Except they didn't call it A, just two more drunks in the Oxford group. And they realized that sitting talking about spirituality is not what had kept Bill sober, nor had kept them sober. What kept them sober was trying to help others, to break down the wall in others. And so through a friend of the doctor, nurse in the hospital, a nun up there, said, we have a guy up here named Bill D, who's a lawyer from Louisville, moved here, and he's a terrible drunk. And at that time, hospitals wouldn't take drunkards, and they would have to have some physical thing. So he's in there for some colitis, a phony diagnosis. She said, I'll talk to his wife. Maybe you can talk to him. So they said, okay. I heard him speak 40 years ago. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron. And my wife came in, said, two fellas want to talk to me about my drinking. I said, absolutely not. I'm sick of people talking about my drinking. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's the end of it. I said, but my wife's a very strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas. And the funny thing is, they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt, and how it felt to be sober. And I never heard anybody describe me like that before. I thought, my God, that's my story. I'm so impressed. I stuck with the fellas. And he became number three in the chain. And they had a hard time getting members because they couldn't take him to AA meetings. They'd have to take him to the Oxford group meeting where they'd talk to him about religion for an hour. They had very few members who stayed around. They finally got a young guy, interesting. He was 29. And they said, you probably can't be an alcoholic when you're that young. But you seem to be drinking a lot. Why don't you come with us and do what we do? So he went with them. It's just this kind of a little sidebar, kind of cute. And he fell in love with the doctor's daughter. And without being aware of it, brought us our first relationship. I don't know a single word that sends a shiver down a sponsor's spine like that word. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. They say important things like, I know I thought the I thought Betty was the girl, Clancy, but when I saw Diane walking out of detox today, I just knew. And now here's the funny part. They got married. And I'll tell you, it seems wonderful. My youngest daughter married a man I sponsored. And I was against it. But all the women in my family were for it. So who do you think won? But I'll tell you the absolute golden example of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, because it's but you can give hints. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. And they told him, now you're married. You stay home and take care of your wife. We'll make all these calls on these drunks. You don't have to do this anymore. You stay home and just be a good husband for a couple months. So he stopped doing it, and they were all so sad when he got drunk and died. That's what alcoholics do. But they continue. Little by little, they got some members. But they discovered one thing, that talking, good talk, doesn't keep people sober. If religion kept people sober, there'd be no need for Alcoholics Anonymous. If anything kept alcoholics sober, there'd be no need for Alcoholics Anonymous. They discovered that breaking down the wall of my case is different was what alcoholics could do for alcoholics. And so they became an integral part of their program. Just another thing in passing, as most of you know, they didn't grow very well. Bill moved back to New York. He had a little group there. They had to take him to the Oxford group, and they'd discourage him. In fact, if you read the book Into Action, the whole chapter almost is how to talk to alcoholics. I was, in 1963, I had the opportunity to sit and talk to Bill Wilson for an hour because somebody else didn't show up for their appointment. And I'd be in the office. And I said, the thing I remember talking to him, I said, Bill, I read a book study, and last month we were reading Into Action, and we talk a lot about going to meetings. And in that chapter, there's not one thing about taking anybody to a meeting. Why? How do you do that? He said, kid, when I wrote that, there were no meetings. Just take him to the Oxford group, and then when he got him alone, had to talk to him all the things they would have heard at a meeting that we do today. But by 1940, they were skulking along through some activities. The Saturday Evening Post at that time had a writer who specialized in uncovering corruption. He had just written an award-winning series on the corrupt Philadelphia labor unions and the docks. His next assignment, worm your way into this new Alcoholics Anonymous thing and blow the whistle on them. Good. And he did. And was surprised. He said, my God, they're doing what they say they're doing. No one's making any money. They're helping each other. It's almost like practicing Christianity. It should be. It never is. He said, it's wonderful. He said, wonderful. So he wrote an article that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in March 1941, and it took the country by storm, because everybody had alcoholics or knew alcoholics there was no answer for, and they all wrote to New York, yes, yes. And Bill was swamped with mail. He sent them each a book. He sent them each a little notice how you could have a meeting. By the end of 1941, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little AA meetings all over America. By 1942, they were flourishing. In 1943, suddenly something came up. Started to get letters. Bill, we're having some problems in our group. People are quitting. People are drinking. Don't bother sending us anymore. One by one, the groups were dying off. By 1944, it became just a cascade of groups dying, people fighting over money, people fighting over who's got the most prominence in their group, fighting over whether or not they're really alcoholics. By 1945, in a desperate attempt to save AA, he started the Grapevine in a big page size, and he thought that'd bring people together. It helped a little bit, not much. But also in the middle of 1945, a doctor in North Carolina, sober doctor, wrote him an article for the Grapevine. He said, I don't know if you ever heard about this, Bill, but this is kind of interesting. And Bill read it. Much to his surprise, he learned just about 100 years before there had been a group exactly like AA of drunkards helping drunkards, the only other instance in history. And six drunks had got together in Baltimore. One had just got out of jail. He went back telling his friends, this, that damn chaplain says he knows how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys are the other guys who know how I feel, and you can't stay sober either. What good does it do? But they said, maybe if we all just work together to help each other stay sober. So they wrote a little constitution, elected five officers, one member. Who do you identify with? And everybody laughed at him. You drunken pukes, you can't stay sober yourself. For Christ, you're going to help each other? But they stayed sober. And some people came down from Philadelphia and discovered if we talked to drunks, we could stay sober. They went back, started a group in Philadelphia, started a group in Washington, started a group in New York, started a group in Boston. One Boston really took off. And after a while, they took the name Washingtonians because they were the first bunch of people that were drunkards who were trying to help drunkards, like Washington was the first person who did what he did. So they could name themselves George Washington. And they started in March, but they took his birthday as their anniversary date. At the end of a year, they figured about 400 sober drunkards, which is pretty impressive. At near the end of their second year, they had chapters all over. Just amazing. They sent out a letter to anyone they could find. Says, on our second anniversary, invite somebody from your community who's an up-and-coming young guy. Not that we care what he's going to tell us, but we want him to see what we're doing, and he can spread the word. So all over the country on February 22, 1842, they invited people in, and Springfield, Illinois, they had this young lawyer, Dr. Abraham Lincoln, came in to be their speaker. If you ever read a book of Lincoln's speeches, it's a great one to the Washingtonians. And much of it was just talk. But near the end, he said, kind of touched, he said, I know you men, and I work with you, and I understand what the wonderful things you do. I've never understood your thirst. I can't explain that. But I see that you're quenching it now with other things. He said, just my hat's off you. But anyway, then the next year, they had, you know, obviously no TV, no movies, no nothing. Entertainment primarily consisted of big mass meetings where they'd bring in a speaker to entertain them or instruct them or do something. They got two or three of these guys into the Oxford group, Washingtonians. So all of a sudden, there's people all over talking to thousands of people about the Washingtonians. And by the end of 5 years, now just think of this, they had an estimated 100,000 sober drunkards. Now, that may not impress you, but just think AA with mail and telephones and everything didn't even have 1,000 after 5 years. And then they got together, the leaders, and they shared their experience, they shared their wisdom, and they came to a conclusion that many people in AA come to today. We've really helped a lot of drunkards, but we have such a strong message. Maybe we should help people who aren't drunkards. Maybe narcotics addicts, not on heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium. Maybe we should help people who are, help the anti-slavery movement. Maybe we should get involved in getting Texas to be a state. Maybe we should use our good forces, our membership, to do good things. And they really all took things up and they just changed the world. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct, and with very few exceptions, they all died drunk on the street. And Bill Wilson wrote this, thought, my God. And he went down and got some books out of the Washingtonians from the library. He said, the things I'm getting in the mail are just the same sort of things these people were fighting about. What can I do? And in late 1955, he sat down, and a lot of people don't remember this, in a desperate attempt to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he wrote the 12 traditions, primarily based on the experience of the Washingtonians as they applied to AA. And he introduced them one by one in the long form, as the young lady read the long form of the seventh tradition in the back of the book, across from the old short forms, the long form. And they introduced them one by one in the grapevine. But there was one problem then, as there is now. We don't know what to do about it. AA is full of alcoholics. Most people didn't want them. We don't want your damn old rules. We're here for love, goddammit. So the next couple of years, Bill Wilson would plant his wife on the side of his motorcycle and drive to groups all over the East Coast explaining, these are not rules, these are efforts to save AA. We're going under if we don't do something. Some people accepted him, some people didn't. By 1949, they realized, he and Dr. Bob, we have to somehow get this message around. All the people I've talked to on the East Coast, I've got some of them, but they're all over the country. And so they thought, maybe if we just had one big meeting somewhere, we could explain it. And it's an interesting thing. The Alcoholics Anonymous members in Akron didn't like the Akron AA members in New York. They thought they were city slickers. People in New York didn't like the people in Akron. Thought they were shit kickers. You know? And so they said, find us a place to live, a place to have a meeting. People in Akron said, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to New York. People in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob Bears got along well together. They came up with Cleveland. All right. So in July in Cleveland, 1950, the first large group of sober alcoholics of our type ever in the history of the world got together in Cleveland. I have the tapes of that convention. I have a picture of it from the rear. Very touching. And even then, they still had a lot of non-alcoholic speakers. At a warden of Sing Sing, warden of San Quentin, government people, because they're still concerned, how do we look to people? They're afraid we're going to think we're weird. And one of the things that happened at that convention, that was very touching, Bill gave a talk, and Dr. Bob gave a talk, and he was dying of cancer. And they said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. He said, well, I've got to talk. I've got 15 years of sobriety, second longest in the whole world. So his son on one side took this tall, gaunt man to the podium, and he said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope we'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we all are doing the same things. We get out of AA, what we put into it, it's a wonderful thing. He said, I want to apologize for my poor health. I've been in bed the last few months. I haven't recovered the way I thought I would. He said, as I look over this vast room, he said, I'm happy that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. You know, just talk, not much. But then he said, but I do want to call your attention to two or three things that you may find interesting. Because he was a much better conveyor of the AA message than Bill ever was. And he knew he was dying. It was almost a dying testament, although he didn't call it that. Just two or three things. And these things are as true today as they were that day. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding and love. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it in the world who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. We're all very wonderful when things are going our way. Love is the answer, baby. But let somebody hurt our feelings. One of the weirdest things about AI know is that all of us have fought the title alcoholic. Nobody ever done that, adopted it gracefully. But after you're sober a while, the worst thing you can say about someone, I don't even think that son of a bitch is alcoholic. Yeah. And we have to learn to deal with that in ourselves. And finally, he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to maybe take us to a few meetings. They're playing our song. None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it so badly. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our fellow man who suffers in the blackness of alcoholic despair. And he sat down and was dead soon thereafter. See, I don't mind. Get his name. But one of the other things that happened at that convention, they had six young guys. Each of them took two traditions and read them and described them. I don't know who they were, because, you know, just oral traditions, tapes. But you know, you just feel their tails wagging. They're so excited and full of it. And they point out, these are not rules. We have no way to enforce them. We just think we must accept them for the good of AA. And that seemed to be right. But some of us old-timers, I don't know about Warren, but I think maybe they went overboard. Maybe it would be nice if we had a few rules. In my community, I'm known as a dictator-type sponsor. My sponsor, Chuck C., you don't share, you tell them. I said, I guess that's right. But what they never realized is you can only be a dictator-type sponsor as long as you have the 100% approval of the dictatee. All he ever has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. I think it would be nice if we had people who came at night and said, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little. But after that, all that, it's a funny thing. Bill Wilson still wasn't sure he had the votes. He knew they were critical. They got all done. He said, you have now heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, we accept them. And they saved Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to remember that sometime when you're sitting in your group thinking just a bunch of old stuff in the back of the book somewhere, because they all have a very strong reason for being there. And one of the most important things is in the fifth tradition. Our message, to carry the message to the alcoholics who still suffer. He saw what happened to the Washingtonians, not to the people who suffer, but the alcoholics who still suffer. And one of the big arguments today in the world, you hear this a lot, go to AA and they fight over this in meetings, breaks up meetings. People come to AA who are not alcoholics and insist on participating. They say, you can't participate, you're not an alcoholic. Yes, I can. Third tradition reads in the short form, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I've got a desire to stop drinking. What do you do about that? I'll tell you what. You go back to the original form of the traditions. The third tradition says we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. And when they abbreviated it, they had no idea that someday non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. You can't get alcoholics, then why would non-alcoholics want to come in? But that's one of the things, always, the alcoholics talking to another alcoholic. That's how Bill started talking to Dr. Bob. And that's how tonight, if you meet a newcomer somewhere, I hope you'll talk to him that way. And that's why we insist on having a singleness of purpose. I'll tell you why. A little something in passing. In the late 1950s, I was just sober. There was a guy in Los Angeles named Jim Willis. I knew him. He was a nice guy. And he was a gambler as well as an alcoholic. And he'd bring his, after he got sober, he'd bring his gambler friends to AA and say, are you being helped? He said, no. We don't want to hear these old juicers. What do they got to say? I'm not like that. So he wrote to New York and got the first person to, he was the first person to ever get permission to use the 12 steps outside of AA. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous, which became very successful. In fact, it's the most successful of all the non-AA 12-step programs. In the early 1960s, he was just whizzing around the country, starting groups and people just admired him a great deal. By 1965, he didn't have time to go to AA anymore. He was helping AA. So everybody got sad when he got drunk and died. But as they said in GA, he never gambled again, which is important to them. In 1959, two guys in North Hollywood who were narcotics addicts, bringing their narcotics friends to meetings, they didn't want to hear about the juicers, got permission to use the 12 steps and founded Narcotics Anonymous. 1961, out in West LA, where I live, some guys got together, cocaine addicts, formed Cocaine Anonymous. A woman in the Mid-Wilshire District founded Overeaters Anonymous, which still are the big four non-AA. And I mean, they're all, you'd think you'd really understand them. I never really understood the difference of identification until I was about 2 years sober. I'd been slipping for 10 years. I was sober now for 2 years. I just was excited I'm sober. I just had my front teeth kicked out so I couldn't tell very clearly. I weighed about 125 pounds, a scrawny, nasty old thing. But I was talking to the club one day, and I was talking on obsessions. And I gave a wonderful talk on obsessions. Not the recovery from them. I don't understand that, but I knew about the obsessions. This rather plump woman comes. She says, oh, that was just fascinating. She said, I've started a little organization called Overeaters Anonymous. We meet over at the Christ the King Church on Olympic Boulevard. Could you come over and Sunday and give that same talk to our ladies? I said, sure. give them something to shoot at, 129 pounds. So I went over there, and there were about eight rather plump women sitting around. And I gave them a wonderful talk on the obsessions. There went. Then I sat down, and I really helped these poor ladies. Then they had a little sharing session, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Woman over here, her son had just had his 10th birthday that Sunday, and he was at a military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to get him and tasted the birthday cake and had another little taste, another little taste. By the time they got back, she'd eaten the whole cake, and she felt so bad about it. And I didn't say anything, because I'm a nice guy, but I wanted to say, why just have a piece of cake and forget it, for Christ's sake, you know. Over here, some woman talking about ice cream. She just loved ice cream. As soon as her husband went to work, she said, and I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. I thought to myself, no wonder you're fat, for God's sakes. They might be fat eating ice cream. But my favorite was a woman over here who ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and puked it up so she could eat some more. And I didn't say anything. I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands after the meeting. I can see doing that for drinking, but not for food. I've done it a lot for drinking. God, Saturday afternoon, the sun's still up. Now, what is the difference? I understood it clearly. I have a good mind, but I didn't identify with it. So it was just eccentric behavior. And that's the way people have looked at us all along. That's why they look at us. That's why. Don't try to convince your folks to understand you, because they never really will, because alcohol doesn't do for them what it does for you and me. And you mean you can't even have a glass of wine at Christmas? No. Oh, come on. Yeah. They're not really trying to be hurtful. That's why what identification is about. Well, that identification is just information, and nobody ever got sober around here on information. There has to be some way to get through that wall. That is why Alcoholics Anonymous again and again starts little programs of self, of singleness of purpose. Because that's what identity, there's nothing new in AA. There's nothing new in that book. I can find same type of thing in a lot of books. Steps are just basic behavior patterns. But the thing that makes AA work is we can get through the wall of the alcoholic and get him to try it. That's the difference. Information can't do that. So that's why we still think you have to be an alcoholic to be an alcoholic. You can be an alcoholic and an addict, alcoholic and a gambler, be an alcoholic and twist baby chicken's necks for all we care. But you got to be an alcoholic and talk about alcohol in meetings, because we want the newcomer to identify, not to listen to how clever you are in discussing how you shot up last week. Okay, so I'm going to go quicker, a little quicker now. Secondly, they want to change the book. And that's understandable, written in an old way, you know, what the hell that's in. And the book is a nice book. I know when I was new, I used to laugh to myself, because everything, the word miracle is widely overused today. Everything's a miracle to somebody, you know. This book is a miracle. I heard a guy a few years ago said, I got up early this morning, I looked in the eastern sky, the sun was coming up, and I said to my wife, darling, it's a miracle. We have another golden day. Oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof. Miracles are supposed to be unexplainable, to be inexplicable. Why is the big book inexplicable? Well, it has some things. The guy that wrote it was 3 years sober, didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Now, if you're new people back there, you may think, when I get to be 3 years sober, I bet I'll know enough to write a book. No, you won't. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy, you're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one? Oh, never mind, I'll get it myself, for Christ's sake. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. And this boob, 33 years sober, no background in medicine, no background in psychology, no background in abnormal psychology, surrounded by people getting drunk again. The 12 stories he put in the back of the book, the first edition, most of them got drunk again. Everybody's getting drunk all the time. Wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives of our type in the last 70 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is what's called a miracle. And they say, well, that's all very nice, but maybe we ought to change it. And of course, there's the one basic exam always is, if it's working, don't fix it. But if you really want to go into that, what would you change? What would you change? Some of the things I don't agree with. Maybe that's the thing that keeps you sober. I think that the whole concept of, I always say, when people, I hear people say that, why don't you write me a sample chapter and let me see it? Well, I don't want to do all that shit. Well, yes, you do. We just think it should be changed. Well, I think you should be changed. You know. I don't really do that, but I like to pretend I do. I try to be gracious and intellectual and say, well, until you have a book that is getting people sober better than this one, we'll stay with this one. That's why we use this book. That's why we don't change it. There was a movement in 2000, in the year 2000, at the international meeting of all the delegates. It came up, let's change the book. And they just debated it at length. Finally, they decided, we'll just move the stories around in the back. But thank God, nobody touched that first 164. And don't you ever let anybody do it. Believe me, because it works. And finally, they talk about the Lord's Prayer. That's really big. You go to Europe, you have to look very hard to find any meeting in Europe that ends with the Lord's Prayer. It's been, you go to Australia, group of some people, friends of mine, started a group down there. That's the only group in Australia and New Zealand that recited the Lord's Prayer. And America, you hear it more and more. I'll tell you something interesting. I spoke at the World Service Office about 6 months ago at their weekly meeting. And they talked to me. They closed their meeting with the Serenity Prayer. I said, why did you close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer? He said, we don't do that anymore. At the World Service Office, if you went to San Antonio, you realize the first big meeting ended with the Lord's Prayer and no other meeting did again. And they say it's a Christian prayer. It's a religious prayer, not like the Serenity Prayer. I have something in my pocket that I'm going to read for you. The Reason We Say the Lord's Prayer by Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson writing a letter to somebody named Russ in 1959. Now, about this business of adding the Lord's Prayer to each AA meeting. This practice probably came from the Oxford groups who were influential in the early days of AA. You have probably noted in AA Comes of Age what the connection of these people with AA really was. I think saying the Lord's Prayer was a custom of theirs following the close of each meeting. Therefore, it quite easily got shifted into a general custom among us. Of course, there are always those who seem to be offended by the introduction of any prayer, whatever, into an ordinary AA gathering. Also, it is sometimes complained that the Lord's Prayer is a Christian document. Nevertheless, this prayer is of such widespread use and recognition that the argument of its true Christian origin seems to be a little far-fetched. It is also true that AAs believe in some kind of God, and that communication and strength is obtainable through His grace. Since this is the general consensus, it seems only right that at least the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer be used in connection with our meetings. It does not seem necessary to defer to the meeting, the feelings of our agnostic and atheist newcomers to the extent of completely hiding our light under a bushel. However, around here, the leader of the meeting usually asks those to join in the Lord's Prayer who feel they would like to do so. The worst that can happen to the objectors is that they have to listen to it. This is doubtless a salutary exercise in tolerance at their stage in progress. But here's a better document. A lot of people, I carry these all the time just in case somebody asks me to speak. This is the Serenity Prayer as written in 1935 by Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking, as Jesus did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that Jesus will make all things right is surrender to His will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with Him forever in the next. Now that's a religious prayer, I'll tell you. I find it funny. Hey. My home group in Los Angeles is called the Pacific Group. It's the largest group in the world. It's almost 1,000 people every Wednesday night. But we meet in a big synagogue. It's the only place big enough to hold us. And sometimes the rabbi comes in, sits in the back row at meeting time, wonders how he can get that many people in there on Friday. But I notice when we say the Lord's Prayer, he jumps up and holds hands and says the Lord's Prayer. The rabbi will say the Lord's Prayer because he believes in it. But some little snot-nosed member sober 16 minutes doesn't like it. Who cares? So on our anniversary, 75th anniversary, in the last 55 minutes, I've told you the current movements going on around the country. And I hope you'll understand why we have a singleness of purpose, because that's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work. Why we use this book, because it works very well. And why we say the Lord's Prayer to a God that we believe and trust in, or come to believe and trust in, certainly. I didn't believe in God till I was sober quite a while, because I was a Norwegian Lutheran from northern Wisconsin, and I was so bad, I knew if God was there, He's going to send me to hell forever and ever. I remember telling my sponsor about that one day. I said to Chuck Chimmer, I said, I don't know what to do. God hates me. He said, son, you're not important enough for God to hate. That's called bad news and good news. But I went home and prayed that night to see if there'd be a lightning bolt, and there wasn't. And I've been praying earnestly to that God with a belief in God over the last 48 years since I heard about that. And it's a wonderful thing. I think the greatest thing, as I said last night at the end of your meeting, and I'll say it tonight, all of the things that go into AA, I mean, I slipped for 10 years. In my drinking days, I was physically thrown out of 2218. They said, get out of here, don't come back. I was a little drunk, not much. And they say in AA, you know, that AA will help you with your drinking, but how about your emotions? How about your feelings? How about the sensitivities? Let me tell you this. In my career, I've been in jail 31 times, which is not a record, but it's good for an advertising executive. I've been committed to the Texas State Insane Asylum for an indefinite period as a successful suicide who was restored to life. I've been in 3 veterans hospitals. I'm really a crazy bastard, is what I am. And I'll tell you this, Alcoholics Anonymous, its book and its steps, works at least 52 years and a half. I don't know if it'll work any longer than that, but I see Warren and I think it will. It'll get me to 54 or 55, and then you're on your own. But I suggest you try it. Stay here and make it work. Because again, as I closed the meeting last night, I don't know how to say it any better. But Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same thing in St. Paul tonight as it was in Akron, Ohio in 1935. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different, at least enough, so that he would begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that comes, the miracle starts. And someday, years to come, some of you, maybe the new guys in the back, will be standing at a podium like this, and I'm just a distant memory somewhere. But I'll tell you one thing you'll come to understand. It's just grand for all of us tonight. We have something in common tonight that people all over the world would die to have. We are safe and sane and sober. Thank you.
So with that, I think we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks again, folks. Appreciate it. Have a great evening.